Peace family, this is Davon Love, director of public policy for Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle. I'm here with Dr. Todd Stephen Burroughs. Appreciate you for being with us, Dr. Burroughs. And I want to say before we jump into things, I know I've said this to you kind of in passing. I really appreciate your work. LBS as a grassroots political organization. And we do our best to really be grounded in grassroots political struggle in the Black radical tradition. Some of the segments that you do with Jared on I Mix What I Like are some of my favorite segments and some of the most informative. And I'm actually really appreciative. One of the things that you sent me as a basis for our conversation actually was the subject of one of my favorite segments that you did with Dr. Ball. So I'm really looking forward to getting into that. But I just wanted to give you that appreciation before we got started, just to tell you that, your work truly is something that is useful to the work that we actually do on the ground here in Baltimore and beyond. So how are you doing?
Fine. I appreciate that very much. That's very humbling. I enjoy being, as I've told Dr. Ball privately, I enjoy being Black Power Media's resident goofball, right? And I like... joking around and all of that. I mean, they're so serious, and they were the ones that introduced me to you folks. And I know you folks are very serious too. So as I told you before we started, I'm going to try to be the serious version of me as serious as I can, because you guys are so hardcore, So I'll do what I can to look stern.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. So let's start. So where we want to end up is to talk about your work on Mumia. So that's kind of where the conversation is going to land. But there are a few things that I want to preface it with, some just discussion points I want to preface it with before we kind of land there. One of the things in seeing your work, over the years, that for me is of great interest is the contemporary state of Black scholarship. And I think, as is the case outside of the academy, not only neoliberalism broadly, but really a de-radicalization of Black studies and a mainstreaming of it is something that I observe as a key feature of some of the political activist activities of like a lot of contemporary activists. So if we take Black studies, contemporary Black studies, we know that, Black scholarly activity as fuel for political activity is something that's been done for centuries, but Black studies in its contemporary context and kind of it being in its inception attempt to really connect the community to institutions that do scholarly work in service of the community, which is distinct from the way that universities ended up absorbing Black studies. If you could talk about reflect on this kind of de-radicalization of Black studies, and particularly with what I think is the unique role of the intellectual work of political prisoners being a part of the radical end of Black studies, and some of the ways that the omission or de-emphasis of political prisoners is something that contributes to this de-radicalization of kind of more broadly this enterprise of Black studies.
Yeah, that was some deepness. You know that was some deepness, right?
I try my best. I learn from the best.
Let me try to match the deepness. I'm going to fail, but I'm going to try to match the deepness of the inquiry, because I appreciate the seriousness of the inquiry. Ironically, you're asking the wrong person, because I'm an outsider to Africana studies. I've only been an Africana studies professor for about 2 to 3 years. I've spent my time in communication studies. And since you understand the structure of Africana studies, you know that communication is not one of the accepted parameters that universities accept as the topic they want in addition to Africana studies. As you know, Africana studies, very few people are hired purely as Africana studies, right? They have another specialty. And so the white university tries to get two, things with one stone by hiring someone in the English department or the history department or the sociology department or the political science department and black studies, right? So I'm an outsider. I've only been an adjunct in Africana studies because, again, I don't fit the established parameter. Communications is not in the established parameter of Africana studies. Now, we can have a discussion about why that is, but it would be a very simple discussion. Communication is trying to be a discipline, trying to rise in the ranks to be the equal of sociology and the other disciplines. And journalism is a trade. So there's always a tension between communication and journalism, right? I have 3 degrees in journalism or 3 degrees in communication, however you define that. So I have no degree in Africana studies. So technically, I am not formally trained in Africana studies, even though Africana studies is interdisciplinary. So for an Africana studies person to accept me as that is an act of kindness, which I appreciate. So the view that I'm giving is an outsider view. And I think your question might be more appropriate for an insider person, but you know, maybe this outsider view might have some kind of perspective that might be interesting to you. In communication studies, we're clear on what we're studying. We're studying communication, mass communication, or interpersonal communication. And for those of us who are scholars, we have some sort of light permission to study propaganda, mental conditioning, et cetera, depending on where you are, depending on what the priorities of the journalism and communication school is. I know, for instance, my specialty in communication is in American journalism history. And my specialty within that is African-American journalism history. Now, nobody in journalism schools in 2022 wants either of those topics. History has been, I'm talking about all history, white journalism history, has become a component of other studies, introductory studies. So it's no longer its own respected interest within the body. And African-American journalism history is such a specialty thing that, you know, it's almost ridiculous to bring it up in terms of scholarly context. What people want in journalism and communication studies now is new media. They want to talk about Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, TikTok. Why? Because they want to study the mental processes of the construction of those things and how those things program people. Now, why do communication schools do that? Well, as Dr. Ball will tell you, Dr. Jared Ball will tell you, who's done extensive research and reading on this, it's always been done from at least World War II up for the purposes of propaganda, brainwashing, and indoctrination of capitalism. So communication schools are well-funded because they serve capitalism. The journalism piece provides well-trained, ready-trained people for journalism jobs. And these scholars study propaganda, technology, et cetera. Why? So that they can help the capitalist industries help develop now demassified media, but now a worldwide media ecosystem. And why do these journalism schools exist? Because they're funded. Who funds them? Well, first newspapers and radio and television foundations funded them because they wanted the training. But now they can get their funding directly from the government and other agencies because the government and other agencies want these kinds of studies. So I'm an outcast not only from Africana studies, but I'm an outcast from communication studies as well. So I have an outsider perspective. So now that I've given a very tangential, parochial outline of my own discipline and my own concentration and specialties, now let me turn to what I've learned very tangentially about Africana studies. I thought communication people were cowardly. But see, communication people have accepted their role in capitalism. So they're not pretending to be something they're not. So people who teach journalism, people who teach, people who do the scholarly stuff, they're not pretending to be against capitalism. They're not pretending to be against the status quo. So they've accepted who they are, and they accept that they're a cog in the wheel, and they accept that and choose to believe that what they're doing is making humanity better by producing very good journalists. And maybe they're right. You know, journalists do very good things on a good day. I love the fact that it was The Intercept or it was Vox, some media institution. You know, they found out that, you know, St. Jude's, you know, the hospital St. Jude's, right? Mm-hmm. With the kids, like who could ever say anything negative, right, about St. Jude's, right? I mean, you know, watching those commercials, them little kids crying and all that, right? And I love Margot Thomas. I just finished binging watching That Girl, you know, her show from the 60s, right? Well, one of these media institutions found out that St. Jude's technically did not charge anybody and gave housing and food and all of that. But you know what they found out? They found out they were doing the minimum of that. And yet they were hoarding $300 million. So they were helping these parents and everything and these kids, but only for like 2 weeks. They were giving food and shelter, but only for 2-3 weeks. And then they was back in their cars while they were hoarding all of this money. And once they exposed that, once the media institutes exposed that, St. Jude changed their policies. Now, if you are not a revolutionary, you say that is part of American progress. That's why we need freedom of the press. That's why freedom of the press exists, to expose wrongdoing so that reforms can take place and society can be better, right? So on a good day, that's what journalism does, right? But to a revolutionary, to a radical, of which I am not, I'm just somebody who believes in those perspectives. And I believe there's those, and I believe that those perspectives are legitimate. But with someone coming from that perspective, all they see is, okay, that's minimal change, right? So the communication professor, they've accepted that. They're not in contradiction, if that makes sense.
Yep, that makes sense.
Because the people who would argue against them, they wouldn't care about anyway. But the Africana studies person has this special tension because they have to decide, okay, are they a person that is studying a subject? Are they a person trying to improve the society? Are they a person that's trying to create reform, perhaps radical reform in the society? Or do they want revolution? So when I entered the field, I thought I was going to see this large range of people that I'd been seeing as a journalist. Right, because many of these folks were public intellectuals before I understood the term. And so I was used to Africana studies, people being like, you know, Dr. Leonard Jeffries, Moana Karanga, people like that, you know, Asante, people like that. And then when I entered the field, I saw that there was a wide variety of people. But what I saw was a lot of cowardice, because everybody did not go into Africana studies to do any kind of reform. And the people that accept these folks and give them great positions, they're not giving them positions for that. So there's not a lot of challenging the status quo. And I'll give you an example of that, and it's a very simple example. Now, I use the books of these people. So if it sounds like I'm attacking them, I'm not. I'm giving a critique. I think Africana studies in terms of individual topics has never been better. I mean, we have a great generation of new scholars, and I'll mention a few. People like Ashley Blaine and people like...
Keisha Blaine.
Keisha Blaine, Ashley Farmer, thank you.
Farmer,
right. And there's some other folks. I forget all their names. But I was in the chat of a Zoom that had some of these people on. And they were talking about, you know, this amazing idea that maybe Reagan was at the start of this kind of craziness that we're dealing with now. I mean, in other words, they were trying to analyze society but they kept stopping short of the Black radical tradition. And I just had to point blank ask, you know, I'm in the chat, I'm an outsider, so I'm in my normal role. So I asked the moderator to ask them, why do all y'all keep stopping with that? And I don't know if you were able to read my essay that I wrote on political prisoners, but I even at length quoted Elizabeth, I forget her name, who did this major book on Black rebellions, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And I quoted her. And like they all have all these facts, and they have all the information, and they have all of this, and then you wait for them to come to a conclusion, and their conclusion falls short. Because they always ride up to the gate of the Black radical tradition, and then the car stalls. And so I just straight up asked the Schomburg host, why is that? Why do you do that? Why can't you just admit that maybe George Jackson and Mumia Abu-Jamal and Angela Davis and all of those people that represent these things were more right than wrong? I don't need you to completely adopt everything they say, but where's this whole body of information that has already given you the analysis that you've just spent years of study and 300 pages to get to? Well, that where you end is where the Black radical tradition begins. All the things you find out at the end of your scholarship are all the presuppositions of the Black radical tradition. So what's going on with that? I mean, you guys are smart. Right? So I asked that, right? Now, there was a white woman on the panel who had a book on radicalism. So after 10 seconds of silence, she jumps in and goes, well, that's why I wrote my book. And, you know, she talked about her book on the radical tradition and all the people she had and everything and all that. And I said, okay, thank you. I even wound up buying her book after that. I said, okay, let me buy your book. Okay, fine. And again, I'm not a radical. I'm not a revolutionary. But I'm somebody who believes that these perspectives are legitimate. That Daruba Ben Wahad is just as legitimate as Christine Vanden Heuvel or whoever. Right? Okay. So to the moderator's credit, she said, you know, I understand your question because in my classes, I do use George Jackson. But I do understand, and this is a phrase I had never heard before. She said, but I do understand, you know, the problems of having the politics of citation. Right. That was my reaction. Your reaction right there was my reaction. And I'm like, uh-huh. So basically what you're telling me, you're giving me the undercover thing of if they go there, the white people who fund them, who give them six-figure jobs, who publish their works, won't like it. That's the cowardice.
Right. And you know, what's interesting, because in that piece you sent over, the contrast that you lay out between the way that BPM, you know, Black Power Media is talking about, you know, political prisoners, particularly the BLA, and the way that Democracy Now would discuss those issues. And, you know, what's interesting, you know, a part of why I wanted to give this preface into the discussion of your work on Mumia is because I think there are times when there are distinctions that are made that I don't know that oftentimes people understand the importance of those distinctions, right? So if you could say a little bit more about like the contrast you draw between BPM and how they approach the issue of political prisoners, Black radical tradition, and the way that Democracy Now handles it and the importance of that distinction you draw.
I want to congratulate you because you're the first person to figure out my main theme as a writer. So you now are in a whole nother category. You get bragging rights with Dr. Ball. You can say like, look, you know, you talk to him all the time, but I was the one to crack the code. Right. Why are these distinctions important? Because they're irritating. To bring these distinctions up are irritating, right? I don't want to attack the leaders of Black Lives Matter when they buy a $6 million house. And I don't want to compare them to, you know, SNCC workers, right? But when you buy a $6 million house, they're like, well, what's the house for? Is the house for political prisoners? Can Matulu go to the house with his family and die? Like, what's the purpose of the house? And you tell me, oh, the purpose is for art. And then, like, yeah, come on, y'all. Come on. I'm not saying that everybody in the present is Uncle Tom's and everybody in the past were these perfect, pristine revolutionaries. I'm not saying that. But I'm pointing out that the problem with the cowardice is that we've now redefined everything in order to make ourselves comfortable. We think that we don't know what happens to us when we speak out. We pretend that. We pretend we don't know what happens to us when we defy the authority, right? So the firing of a Tiffany Cross, for instance, still shocks us, right? But we know MSNBC with the way they treated Melissa Harris Perry. We know MSNBC. So, but we're continually shocked that when people stand up and stand out, they get their head cut off. And that's why, I think it was Raoul Peck in his documentary on slavery and the, Middle Passage and all that. He started with the theme, and it's not knowledge we lack. We know exactly what happens to us. That's why, when we look at the George Floyd incident from the other side, remember there was another camera in the street who was taking a picture of the people on the sidewalk. Remember that? And you had the white woman EMT. She was so upset. And you saw the sister who were praising all the time, which we should praise for being that young and that brave doing that. My hand would have shook all over the place shaking that. She stood right there standing strong, right? Recording. We saw her. We saw everybody, right? We saw people frustrated in the street. And I'm sitting here thinking, so we forgot how to throw a rock, huh? In the 60s, somebody would just picked up a brick and thrown it. Chauvin would have gotten off George Floyd. George Floyd would have been alive. And a whole bunch of black people who have funding now would not have that funding. Can I be honest with you?
Yes, sir.
So the people at that corner knew the consequences of throwing the brick. They didn't have to know who Mumia was or who Mutulu was. They didn't have to know. Like, they don't know details. And see, we think, oh, if we just give them a bunch of details, they'll be conscious. No, they don't need the details because they know they can't throw a brick at the cop. Why? Because they kill them. Or put them in jail for 20 years, assaulting a police officer, starting a riot. We all, I mean, it's all intrinsic. It's in our genetics now, the fear. It's there. And we also make the mistake in thinking that other groups of people don't understand this dynamic either. And I don't know why we do that either, because when you see my segments with Dr. Ball, you see I'm always joking about comics and stuff like that. Okay, one of the things I mentioned to him was this new Star Wars show. I don't know if you watch Star. You seem like a serious black man. You probably don't watch a Star Wars show. You're like a very serious black man, so you probably don't watch this show called Star Wars Andor. But I wish you should, and I wish you could, and I wish you would use it in your political education classes. You'd get a lot of young people if you said, we're talking about Star Wars. And now, why? Because when you watch the 10 episodes they've aired, they got two more left. When you watch the 10 episodes they've aired, that whole show, which is a prequel to Star Wars Rogue One, whether you have two people in there who lead in the revolution and they die at the end of the film, right? So we're watching a dying man. We're watching how a dying man goes from no political consciousness to political consciousness. That's what this show is about. This show is about Malcolm X's statement that if you knew what a revolution was, you wouldn't say you're in one. Because Star Wars Andor is about the price of revolution that we don't want to talk about. And Stellan Skarsgård does this monologue at the end of the last episode. People are going to be using this monologue to get jobs acting. I've heard geek commentators compare it to Shakespeare or whatever. And it's about somebody made the mistake of asking him, well, what have you sacrificed for the revolution? He said, what have I sacrificed? And then he went into this whole thing on what he sacrificed, which we should listen to. So the fiction, the popular fiction is replete with all the material on human suffering and the response to it, all of the responses to it, including the so-called violent response that they so-called are against, right? Mm-hmm. And I say so-called violent because there's this thing called so-called nonviolence, right? which pretends it's not violence, right? Mm-hmm. Now, you know what I mean by that. You're very sophisticated. You know what I mean by that. You know I mean that You have one idea of violence, right? Well, we need the violent overthrow of the system, right? Then you have this other idea that says we need to cause violence and make the society so disruptive that they can't function, and then we can go in and get the reforms we need. That's nonviolence. And I say that as a former Martin Luther King scholar at Seton Hall University. I say that as someone who's read every biography of Martin Luther King since his death, starting with David Levering Lewis's in 1968. So it's not like there's no party that doesn't understand the dynamic. It's just that we're afraid. This is the new thing. We're afraid. Because in the 60s, whoever threw that brick had absolutely nothing to lose. Living in substandard housing, not getting an education, not having a future for their children. That person has nothing to lose by throwing the brick. But everybody at that corner had something to lose by throwing the brick. So they couldn't throw the brick. It's the fear that's different. It's, again, Raoul Peck, it's not knowledge we lack. So we're in a dilemma. Because, see, I just finished reading a book called Meme Wars. I have it right here. I'm going to pull it out. There's this book, and I learned about this book from Democracy Now. See this book right here? Meme Wars.
Mm-hmm.
Written by two scholars and a journalist. What is it about? It's about how we got into this situation with January 6th. And their argument is that the media ecosystem, the underground one, Reddit and all of this stuff, it got to develop, it got to fester, and then thanks to Trump, it got mainstreamed. Now, guess where they learned all that from? They learned all that from us, from Occupy. There's not one of our movements that they have not studied in detail. They studied Occupy, the success, the failure, how people communicated, and said, we're going to replicate that. And that's how we got Bannon and Alex Jones and all of them folks. That's how we got them. And to show you that this is not a new phenomenon, there's a historian by the name of Eric Foner, who's one of the top historians in the United States. He's written all these books on Reconstruction and the development of the Republican Party and the Civil War, you know, the original Republican Party, right? That Lincoln was the candidate of. You know who's one of the top fans of his book about the Republican Party? Karl Rove. Karl Rove was quoted as saying, I read Eric Foner's book on the Republican Party, and it taught me how to organize disparate interests.
Oh.
They're using their information and they're using our information. So ironically, while they ban our information across the country, they have studied it, taken what is useful of it and used it for their own movement. Because they are not afraid.
And so would you say that, like, in terms of the distinction between BPM and Democracy Now, how they talk about political prisoners, that you would really describe the distinction being that Democracy Now, those folks, that audience have things to lose, that these are folks that have essentially capitulated to the fear that I would, in paraphrasing what you just laid out, it's kind of ubiquitous at this point.
Well, Democracy Now! Has capitulated to the money they now have. Democracy Now!, when Democracy Now! Came out, it was only just a little bit less radical than BPM. I was in Democracy Now! When it came out in 1996. And if Mumia sneezed, he was on. Okay. In my not yet published book on Mumia, I talk about all the time Democracy Now! Caught hell from airing Mumia, caught hell for interviewing Mumia and dealing with political prisoners. Political prisoners was one of the top 15 topics, but that was $3 million ago. Now I can't tell the difference between Democracy Now! And MSNBC. They have the same roster. What Amy Goodman would say is, well, MSNBC got smart. I would say, no, what happened is y'all went mainstream. And clearly, the majority of their funding is from the environmental folks. And I don't blame the environmental folks. We need somebody to talk about the environment every day. It was 70 degrees here today in Newark, New Jersey. It's mid-November. That's disturbing. So we need, ironically, we need Democracy Now! To talk about this every day. But Democracy Now! Has radically changed from its first few years. So when I compare BPM to Democracy Now!, I'm comparing BPM to the current Democracy Now!, not the original Democracy Now!.
And so you started to talk about Mumia. For those who will be listening to this, I imagine most people who listen to this would be familiar, but for those who may be less familiar, could you talk a little bit about Mumia Abu-Jamal, of course, who he was leading up to becoming a political prisoner, why he's relevant to Black radical struggle.
Well, Mumia Abu-Jamal has become the poster child for Black political prisoners because of his charismatic nature and the fact that he's an extraordinary writer, an extraordinary broadcaster. He was one of a generation of baby boomer young people who got involved in the civil rights movement and Black power movement and then went to the new professions that had sprouted up that grabbed young people who were articulate and smart. And one of those professions was broadcasting. Mumia becomes a journalist at the same time Oprah Winfrey becomes a journalist. Mumia drops out of school the same time Oprah Winfrey drops out of school. This is not accidental. Whole new opportunities were being born. So Oprah's 19 years old doing a newscast. TV newscast. TV newscast, local TV newscast is a brand new thing. In Mississippi, a young brother, 19 years old, named Randall Pinkston, was doing a newscast. He would later become a national correspondent on CBS News and travel the world. So all of these opportunities opened up overnight. And all these young baby boomer folks ran into them. One of those opportunities happened as a result of our struggle. Black radio, and by Black radio, I mean Black formatted radio, in the 50s and 60s were owned by local whites. And, they were used as ways to promote, local businesses and local dances and things like that. And there was some payola, for recordings and all of that. And so some of these local business people, because they were now around Black people and they were now engaged in Black cultural development, even though many of them were, copying off of Black people, appropriating from Black people in terms of these white DJs would sound Black, like Wolfman Jack comes out of that tradition. If you remember Wolfman Jack, he comes out of that tradition, right? Of the white person sounding Black, right? And you see Wolfman Jack, he's represented in this new, very funny movie about Weird Al Yankovic, starring Daniel Radcliffe, right? I didn't think Daniel Radcliffe was going to be the comic genius out of the Harry Potter trio. I thought Rupert Grint was going to be, who played Weasley, right? I thought he was going to be the comic genius, but it turns out Radcliffe is the comic genius because they do a great movie making fun of biopics and making fun of because something's in a movie, you believe it. So they do all these very funny things in the Weird Al story because they're not taking it seriously because they're making fun of the fact that you take it seriously, right? So Wolfman Jack, like, comes out of this tradition, right? So these white people, because of their proximity with us, they started to become sympathetic to our struggle. And as a result of that, they allowed the DJs to do some more, little undercover kind of political work, some kind of undercover codes that they could say on the air about things. In many cases, like in Philadelphia, where Mumia was born and raised, there was a DJ named Georgie Woods with the Goods. And Georgie Woods with the Goods was the vice president of the Philadelphia NAACP. The president of the NAACP was a Black nationalist. So imagine you got a Black nationalist president and the vice president, and you can tell the vice president, yo, go on the radio and tell folks we're going to be at this place, we can protest, da 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 da. And that's what Georgie Woods did. Now, you know they ran that guy out of town, right? The National NAACP ran. Not only did they take away his presidency, they broke up the chapter so that they could break up the power structure he had set up in there. And I forgot his name, but I'll give you his name when we're done off the air and you can put his name on the screen or whatever. And so Black radio had this power to organize Black people that the Black DJs had started to use in the 60s. This was during the rebellions, and when the rebellions got real hot in terms of 67, 68, 69, Black radio was literally the forum for people to express themselves, and it was a forum for our leaders to get on to try to calm our people down because we were burning up. I'm not going to say our own neighborhoods because I have a little bit more sophistication than that. I'll say we were burning down neighborhoods we resided in. Right? What does this have to do with Mumia? As a result of all of this, Black radio created a brand new position in the late 60s and early 70s called Black Newscaster. So they were paying young Black people to go around the Black community, find out what was going on, come back to the radio station, and put it on the radio. And Black people being sophisticated, not only did they create local networks of these Black radio hosts and newscasters and all these folks, they then created a national Black network. So when I was a child growing up in the early 70s, all I knew was our AM radio with our local Black radio host who we would see in the Black community. And there was this thing called NBN News would come on, and that was the national Black news. And all the Black radio folks from all these different small stations would contribute to the national newscast. And I bet you can guess who the Philadelphia representative was. Was Mumia. So we're talking about an incubator. We're talking about Black people having control over their own communities. Why? Because they controlled information about their communities, so they knew what was going on in their communities, so they could respond and develop within their communities. And they used, like true revolutionaries, the, as you know, revolutionary, the first thing you take down or take over is a radio station. So we had the radio stations. But what happened? Capitalism. Stations were bought by conglomerates. They implemented something called the Drake format that they translated into programming as more music, less talk. That's how that began. So Mamiya,
yeah, that background.
So Mamiya is ousted from this environment. He does NPR too, by the way. He does NPR. He's on the same station that Terry Gross comes out of with Fresh Air, and he does that, but he doesn't fit into this corporate environment. Now, there's a lot of mythology about Mumia getting kicked off the radio because he recorded on police brutality and because he talked the move and all that. That's a lot of mythology. I don't like mythology as a biographer, so I have to tell the truth as a biographer. So I'm going to give you the truthful version of what happened to Mumia on the radio. Mumia would not fit into the corporate environment. They gave him a tryout on the local television news. He was interviewing Dr. J on the local television news. He had a covering over, he had a hat on his head because he couldn't have his dreadlocks be on TV. But Mumia could have been in local TV news making six figures or the equivalent of it, but he wouldn't conform. He was independent. He had that Panther mentality. He was independent. He was decolonized. Yes, he interviewed Move when nobody else would. Correct. Yes, he did do stories on police brutality. Big deal. So did a whole bunch of other people. He's not in jail because he recorded on police brutality. He's in jail because he went into a glove compartment, pulled out a gun, and ran across the street with it to confront somebody who was clearly designed to be an enemy to at least his brother, if not everybody else. That's why he's in jail. Not this mythology just, bullshit. Okay?
And So Mumia,
he gets kicked off the radio because he becomes such a follower of John Africa, he can't talk about anything else. And that's why he gets kicked off the radio. He falls in love with Move the way he falls in love with the Panthers. And so he gets kicked off the radio, has to do freelancing, gets a job as a cabbie, carries a gun with him because that's a dangerous job as a cabbie at night in the urban area. And that's when he sees his brother getting accosted by a police officer. So he gets into the glove compartment, pulls out his gun, and crosses the street. And what happens after that? Well, I wasn't there. There are whole books on what happened, right? After that, and anybody wants to read those books, they can go to Amazon.com. They can read all the books about what happened there. But that gives you kind of an outline of who Mumia is. And so he brings all of that, the Panther, the radio broadcasting, the skill, the intelligence, the reading and all that. He brings all of that to jail. And some white people discover him and realize this is the greatest anti-death penalty person we could ever use. And then he becomes an international phenomenon with a book contract, a top agent, etc. All provided by whites. But Move was at the beginning of it to introduce the whites to him. So if it wasn't for Pam Africa, Mumia would have been dead a long time ago. Pam and Ramona, they're the only reason he's alive. Because he introduced, because they kept him alive. And they introduced him to the white people who then set up the apparatus, the communication apparatus, to get him up. And my book that I haven't published yet is about that. That's the story I tell.
No, and I really appreciate the context that you lay out, the incubator, as you put it, that produces Mumia and his politics. And even what you just ended with, the piece around white folks getting a hold of his story from the death penalty lens, and that being the basis for how they publicize it. Because even when I think about my own political socialization, you know, political prisoners, and Mamiya in particular, we get from the vantage point of the injustice of him being incarcerated, and some of his, you know, political intellectual contributions. But even understanding the entities, the context that incubates him in his perspective, is something that I imagine even on the left's mainstream conversation, Rebel B and political prisoners, it is that intellectual genealogy that to me gets lost. And I think it's really important in understanding why it is that Mumia is a political prisoner. So I really appreciate,
well,
you know,
I mean,
just like
that
the context you laid out.
Yeah, that genealogy is complex because you have to understand a lot of things about the Black struggle. So, for instance, let me give you an example about Mumia's behavior at his trial, something I've been very critical of, right? Mumia's trial was a comedy. I mean, I read the transcript. I was like, okay, this can't really have happened. And I don't mean just that the judge shot down everything Mumia did. It's how Mumia started to be engaged in the process, saw he was being set up, and instead of going to the Black community and saying, I'm being set up, give me some top lawyers, which he could have gotten because they were fundraising for him, he instead turned to John Africa. And then the trial becomes, I want John Africa to represent me. Well, John Africa doesn't have a law license, so he can't represent. And then that whole thing, and then he keeps going around and around with that. And I'm reading this going, okay, Mumia's a smart guy. Why is he acting like a damn fool here? Why is he acting like an idiot here? And I first think in mainstream ways and going, okay, this is ridiculous. And then I have to go, no, okay, he's a revolutionary. So let's think in revolutionary terms. Why is he doing this? Well, he's doing this why? Because he watched John Africa get off a felony charge by representing himself. And he loves John Africa. He loves Move. But why else might he be acting the fool? Because this thing is set up for him to get the death penalty anyway. So he's trying to disrupt the trial and throw the trial into chaos so that no matter what happens, people can see that this is a travesty of justice and maybe he could get some appeal down the line. Now, he said a very interesting thing to Lynn Washington in 1995. You know, when they had that, you remember they had that big hearing when they were trying to kill him, like 3 weeks later, they were having this big hearing with the same judge. You remember that, Judge Sabo. And Mumia says, now, you know, excuse me, this is when they stayed the execution. So he's talking to Lynn Washington after they had stayed the execution. And he pointed out to Lynn Washington, he said, look, you know, this is in the Philadelphia New Observer. You can find it if you look it up under Lynn Washington. He said, you know, notice how the people who were critics of me in terms of how I behaved in the original trial, notice how I behave now. I let my lawyer speak for me. I was calm. I was quiet. I was respectful. What happened as a result of that? My lawyer gets kicked out of the trial and arrested. And the judge comes down with the exact same sentence. So he said, so people who make such a big deal about how I behaved at the trial need to look at the system. I did everything the system demanded this time. And I got the same result. So as a biographer, you know, writing about Mumia is very tricky because I have to remember he's decolonized. The man rode around town on a bicycle and in overalls. He was not a normal dude. You know, when he was arrested, one of the things that the Philadelphia Inquirer mentions in the article of his arrest was he was president of the Philadelphia Marijuana Users Association, a group he had done a story on. Right? He decided after the story, hey, you guys have a good group. I want to join it. He joined and became president, right? He wasn't just president of the Black Journalists Association. He was the outgoing president of the Black Journalists Association, but he was the current president of the Black Marijuana Users Association. And, you know, marijuana is much more accepted now than it was back in December in 1981, right? So this is a decolonized cat, right? Pun intended. Right, so you can't go by normal Robert's Rules of Order type things with Mumia because he's on another frequency, he's on another vibration. So it's a challenge to be his biographer because I have to constantly remember that.
So to round out this time, can you talk about just your work, your upcoming work on Mumia, and what inspired you to do the work, the upcoming work that you're about to release on Mumia?
Well, I'm not about to release it because Mumia's life isn't over. I want to do a full biography, so I have to see if I can stay alive enough to have the story come to the conclusion that it must come to. So I don't know when that work is going to be out. I have a current work out, which is an anthology called The Trials of Mumia Abu-Jamal, a biography in 25 voices, where I essentially take some of my notes and some of my writings and add it with other people's writings. And we kind of have a collective chorus of discussion of Mumia. And that book is the book that's currently out by Diasporic Africa Press. My publisher is Dr. Kwasi Kanadu, the MacArthur Fellow at Colgate University, a very dedicated Pan-Africanist who's written major books on African society. I mean, he has a book out on, I don't know, 15th century Portuguese interaction with Africans and slavery. I mean, really, really heavy stuff. I mean, you're going Portuguese to go into the library and around Europe to read all these like 15th century documents. He's a very heavy cat. That's my publisher. And so that book is currently out, and that gives a variety of voices. And that includes, you know, to go back to our discussion about Africana studies, it includes an article of why is Mumia not accepted in Africana studies? He is an object in Africana studies. He's not a scholar. He's not a thinker whose views are discussed and assessed. He's an object. Now, is that the over-professionalization of the field, or is that the fear? The fear that if you deal with him as a historian and scholar, you then have to analyze and assess his ideas. So the book is filled with all of, you know, articles from all sorts of people, from all sorts of perspectives of Mumia, and that's the book that's currently out. Now, the main book, to answer your question, is a book explaining Mumia in the context of this media ecosystem. His development as a writer in the Black Panther newspaper. Then his development as a radio broadcaster, first in college, then on WHAT, and then on the NPR station, then WUHY, now WYHY, the station that getting their fresh air comes out of, Terry Gross's Fresh HYY. And then this amazing thing where he's in prison and he sets up a media network of articles that get distributed around the country, of audio that gets distributed around the country. He starts doing speeches. He starts doing all sorts of things. He calls into Democracy Now! Live, and they pull the authorities pull the phone off the wall. So all this harassment that happens, why? Because he's successful in creating a media infrastructure for what? For recipes? No, he wouldn't be bothered if he was doing all this, you know, for recipes. He's talking about radical change revolution, and they can't stand that. And so they create special rules for him, or special rules for the whole prison that come from him. And I document as many of those things as I can remember. And I show and I chart his development as a writer and a scholar. And so now he's an elder scholar. So he's gone from young 20-something journalist, burned-out revolutionary, to now an elder statesman, all behind bars, and producing quality work behind bars that many of us out here should be ashamed that we're out here and not producing. For instance, when people think of Mumia Abu-Jamal, they think, oh, he's an essayist. He writes these essays, these op-eds, these commentaries. Mumia's written four or five books of history. His master's thesis was on Black religion. He wrote a book on Black religion. He wrote a history of the Black Panther Party, very good history. He's in jail. He's writing good history books from jail, right? He writes a three-volume work with Stephen Victoria, the guy who did the documentary on him. He writes a three-volume work about the American Empire that nobody has ever quoted yet. He wrote a whole book on the distortion of American history. He wrote a whole book on the war machine, and he wrote a whole book on the corruption of American institutions. I'm still waiting for somebody to quote from it. The books are 400 pages a piece, and I think people didn't feel like reading it. But what if I told you, in addition to all of that, he started the scholarship. He started the scholarship on jailhouse lawyering. He did the first study of jailhouse lawyering in the United States. Well, how did he do that? He had to do interviews. He sent out interview packets, and people filled out the forms and mailed it back to him.
Wow.
Exactly. Wow. And we talk about out here what we can't do. Right? We should be ashamed. But the mentality that produces a Mumia, that's done without fear. And that's why we can't do that now. He was never afraid of them folks. And he's still not afraid of them folks. Do you see?
No, and I mean, even like some of what you just laid out, like some of the texts, like those are texts I definitely gotta get my hand on. I know the two that I'm familiar with is Live from Death Row and Writing on the Wall. And I know that I've actually used, my background is in policy, intellectual backgrounds in policy debate. And one of the most useful aspects of Mumia Abu-Jamal's work. When we would debate white debaters who would try to talk about the importance of US hegemony and US hegemony, they would talk about the downside of US hegemony, what it would cause, world nuclear war and configuration. And one of the arguments that we said to refute it for Mumia, as he described the condition of Black people globally, as being in a state equivalent to nuclear weapons being dropped on Black people, on a regular basis. And that being kind of a conceptual frame to think about, contrasting the position Black people occupy versus white folks and white society. So I'm really glad you laid out like some of the intellectual contributions that many people may not be aware of, even myself, to
Mumia's
really
written
use.
12 books, and people only talk about the one or two they've seen or read. He's written 12 books. And if you're a revolutionary, I don't understand how you haven't read the three books he wrote, Murder Incorporated, which is on the decline of the American Empire. Those are the books I talked about where he went after everybody. He went after the history liars. He went after the warmongers. He did a whole, the second volume is all about the capitalism war machine. And the third volume is all about the corruption of the courts and the media. And I'm like, and I'm waiting for revolutionaries to read these and use these and quote these. And I'm still waiting. And I'm like, y'all say y'all love Mumia, but I don't see any studying. I don't see any assessment. I mean, I'm a biographer. It's my job to do that. But I'm saying people talking about they revolutionaries and they love Mumia and they love political prisoners. Well, where's the analysis they're giving? You know, we have to deal with that.
Yeah.
We have to deal with that. And so, I mean, there's so much to do for activists, for radicals. Again, I'm not that. I again think these perspectives are legitimate. And so when I see things that buttress and fortify their legitimate nature, I call them out. That's why I think Star Wars Andor is important to show to some kids. But you got to sit with the kids and explain to them Star Wars Andor. You just can't show it to them. You've got to explain it to them. Because when I talked about it in Black Power Media, in the chat, people were saying, yeah, you know, the guy was groomed in terms of his beard and all that. They look like Stalin. See, I didn't catch that.
Mm-hmm.
See, they may have done that accidentally. You know, they make mistakes sometimes, you know. Right?
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, we could show them Star Wars and say, okay, look, see what they're going through? That's what our people went through. That's why these people have been in prison 50 years. Because they did these exact things. They did a Brinks robbery in Andor. That was episodes 3 through 4. I mean, 3 through 7. They just did a prison break in Andor. That's episodes 7 through 10. The episode that just ended last week was about the prison break. So they're doing all the things that revolutionaries have done, and we're not even assessing that, and we're not even showing the children that. And we worried about what Wakanda's doing to them. Well, instead of worrying about what Wakanda's doing to them, we need to show them this other stuff that's really about us.
Mm-hmm.
See?
Mm. Yeah. Well, look, man, we come up.
It's been great talking with you. Is there any last thing you want to ask me?
No, I was about to say, we coming up on an hour. Definitely want to respect your time, man. Really appreciate you know, you for doing this, and definitely at some point want to do this again.
Well, look, I really appreciate this, and I hope that people will read, if we're going to talk about Mumia, I hope people will read Live from Death Row. I hope people will read Death Blossoms. That's his spiritual book, his book of spiritual writings, which I think are extremely powerful. I hope people will read We Want Freedom, his history of the Black Panther Party. He definitely takes a strong position. You know what side he's on in the Cleaver Newton field feud. You know, he takes a very specific side, and that should be assessed and talked about. And I hope people read his 3-volume work, Murder Incorporated, on the decline of the empire, because there's all these things in here that he's just waiting for you guys to use. You know, you hear, you know, Jesse Jackson and you know, and now Al Sharpton talk about how we're not using our vote and all of that, you know, the controversy, you know, because some people disagree with that. But I mean, Mumia is laying out all these arguments that people are not using. And I'm just confused as to why we're not even exercising the discipline to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Since we say we love Mumia, well, he's giving you charts, he's giving you crayons, he's giving you sheets of paper, he's giving you the analysis. So let's use it. I mean, that's all I can really say. Because for this audience, I know you guys are serious about struggling about political prisons. So we have to look at it. So thank you very much.
Yeah, man. I appreciate it. I'm going to definitely check out all those works. And like I said, I appreciate this, man. Hope we can do this again sometime.
You can find my book reviews on much of Mumia's work on my blog, Drums in the Global Village. And you can find all 3 reviews of all 3 volumes of Murder Incorporated on Dr. Ball's site, imixwhatilike.org.
Got it. All
right, thank
man,
you
I'll
so much.
Check it out. All right, man. You take
thank
care.
Thank you so much. You too.
All right, peace.
Take care.